This is the third talk in the sequence of four talks on anatta, and it's framed by talking about it in terms of the story of the me. And tonight, I'd like to talk about the need to be somebody. The need to be somebody. There's an old adage in meditation that you must be somebody before you can open up to being nobody. It's like I remember one of Lily Tomlin's characters. She said, I always wanted to be somebody. I guess I should have been more specific. So many of us, I think, are on the path of being somebody, and suddenly we're dealing with a talk or a series of talks or a principle of the tradition that we're involved in that really pulls the rug out, or seems to pull the rug out, from much of what we hold to be the purpose and meaning of our life, our existence, the things we do, and why we do it. And so, first of all, I want to explain this in a very calming, reassuring way, that we're not going to take anything from you. That's not the point of Buddhism. It never was. In fact, not to be upset at all by these points of reference, but rather, this is a call to just investigate and to see whether it holds some truth for us or not. So there's no ripping away here. You don't have to give up anything, actually. In fact, for lay practice, there are actually two ways that most people access or can access this very subtle, yet very the foundation of Buddhism. The principle is so important. One way is through deep and prolonged meditation, almost monastic perseverance. And the mind gets very, very subtle on those long, continuous retreats, where you really begin to see at a almost microscopic level of things breaking up and breaking down, and insights into the sort of those core issues begin to become very apparent from that level of subtlety and seeing. But many of us, perhaps most of us, will not have the opportunity to invite that kind of close inspection of our mind and body process. And so we have to find another way to do that, because this principle can't remain outside of us if we are to ingest the true meaning of Buddhism. And so the second way is the way that I am most that represents my particular path through this. And I also think it's probably the calling of most lay Buddhists as well, and that is the process of investigation. Rather than prolonged 16-hour days of meditating continuously, awakening to the curiosity feature or character that we all have, if we can arouse it. And the homework is meant to do just that. But you can, I mean, you're going to have to meet the same mind states, the same hindrances when you read that homework sheet and you go, well, the first line, I think, is to do a thorough self-assessment. And you go, oh, I don't have time for that. Well, that's it. Isn't it? Right there. I don't have time for that. We've dissipated any interest or any focus because we don't see it as important enough for us to take time. If we saw it was important enough, then we would do it without question. And it's that sense of essential, of urgency, that I think is has to accompany this form of investigation. It can't be just a casual thing. Because the whole of our lives bifurcate at that particular juncture, the juncture of me. If the purpose of life is to add to it and to empower it and to self-improve it and to accomplish and to acquire, which are all the strategies from the sense of I, then our life is going to go in a very different direction than if our life focus was to question what we are and who we are, and to see whether and what that brings forth from that sense of questioning. Because if we, there isn't really, we either strengthen it and strengthen the hold it has upon us and strengthen the assumptions of which make up its packaging, or we question the assumptions. We either strengthen them or we question them. And so one leads to the sort of political turmoil that we're in as a country. The other leads to genuine creativity, spontaneity, and heartfelt action. And we can't have it both ways. We can't go this route and expect our heart to open. It just doesn't in that way. So this is it's all of Buddhism is built upon this. So I can't overemphasize it enough. And many teachers, I think, kind of avoid the subject because of its challenge. But what are we doing if we avoid challenges? So this is what this series is about, and a very important series, I think it is. I thought, there may be the thinning out of some ranks here if I go into this. But then I thought, then there's thinning out of the ranks. It's all right. Now, just to give you a sense, I once went to an art museum that was showing Zen art on the third floor, but to get to the third floor, you had to walk up the first two floors of Western art. And so I was browsing the Western art on my way to the third floor and just was noticing the solidity of form of the first two floors, in which the figure really represented bulk and solidity. And then I walked up to the third floor, which was the Zen art, and it was just the opposite. It was the figure was a wisp of the brush, and there might be a huge mountain and a waterfall and a little person in proportion to that scene. And I thought, there we are in context with nature, and the other one is that we're kind of empowered, the empowered figure on the planet, on the first two floors. And it's really the invitation of this particular investigation into anatta that leads to whether we stop on the first two floors or head to the third floor. So this is not an attempt to pull anything away from you at all. And it's not an attempt to sort of rub your face in something that you don't want to take part in. But what makes all the difference as we move through the strategies of our life in whatever way we feel most appropriate is the knowing of what we're doing. The knowing of what we're doing. The knowing that we are being greedy. The knowing that we are being selfish. The knowing that we are being heartfelt, and the investigation of the principles by which we live that allow for a deeper sense of that knowing. That knowing. Because we can go off, and many of us do, even if we've had deep understandings of anatta, we go off into the direction of body and person empowerment anyway, because of the conditioning of it is so strong. But yet, at least there's a knowing in us. Okay, I know what I'm doing. I just don't want to stop it, or I can't stop it, but at least I know what I'm doing here. To make the unconscious conscious, that has to be there. We have to be willing to admit that we need to be more somebody. Some of us don't feel like we're somebody enough. I'm not taking on this nobody stuff. I want more somebody. Okay. That's okay. So we're going to explore why is it that we sort of cash in our chips and become somebody rather than to allow the silence that underlines all this activity. I mean, it's white noise of somebodyness against the backdrop and foundation of stillness and nobodiness. I'm nobody. Who are you? Says Emily Dickinson. Are you nobody too? But don't say it too loud, or they'll banish us, you know. Why? Because everything's built around us being somebody. Everything. Our whole economic influence, the way this culture runs. And so part of our need to be somebody is the enculturation of everyone else doing it. And we've been bred genetically almost from day one to think that way. And so we're driven, our somebodyness is driven by pain for the greatest part. We become somebody because we're in pain. Because if we ever stopped, the pain would catch up to us like a tsunami wave. It would crest on us. We just run just outside the wave of that crest. And most of our somebodyness has often childhood issues associated with it. The need to be acknowledged. Wanting to be acknowledged, wanting parental consent or parental blessings, acceptance. And we get driven in the pursuit of that acknowledgement, in the pursuit of that acceptance, by the things that we creatively do, or the things that we act, or the things that we build, or the ways that we are. That's the way we have found we can get acknowledgement. Write a book. And so we often do those things not for us, but for the relationship that I can have with other people, the respect that I can get, the validity, self-validation I can receive. When I was writing the book I wrote several years ago, I was just, in the beginning, I was just writing it because it was fun to write, put together hospice stories, and it was just fun. I really enjoyed doing it, and it was creative. And then a friend came over and was reading it, and he said, oh, you could publish this. And then all of a sudden, it wasn't fun anymore because it became not for me in the spirit of what I was doing, but for the product that I could make of it. And then it became work. And it robbed me of a lot of creativity, I think. As soon as we adjust our weight so that the weight is no longer on feeding our aliveness, but rather it's on the weight of making something from it, making an image and representation of it, our artwork, our writing, our speaking, whatever job you do, then the focus gets all screwed up, really. And the fun goes out of it, for the most part. And really, so much of when we lose that focus is because we're searching for some sense of ourselves within the product line. And really that search is a search for contentment. We want to rest. We want to be self-accepting. But we're too dependent upon other people's views or assumptions about us to ever be solitary enough alone to feel the contentment that's at hand. It's always the contentment that I need that you can bestow upon me. And we look for that self-approving mechanism through the relationships we have with the world. Because we're driven by an undernourished sense of that in ourselves. We have never learned how to adjust ourselves and be content, how to find contentment in this moment, how to even acknowledge that there may be contentment in this moment. It's always due to my having to produce more. But meditation is a, its whole purpose is to drop us out of that, to drop us into the center of this hub of activity, to drop us into the hub, into the center of that. And to question this need to perfect ourselves, to be respectable, to look into other people's eyes for my own sense of validation. And because most of us have been driven by this sense of discontent within us, when we fall into meditation, when we take a seat on our pillow, that's the first thing that hits us, as to how discontent we are, how restless. And then we operate with the influences of the mind in terms of that sense of discontentment. Nothing's ever enough. I can never really rest because this particular moment with all of its hindrances isn't sufficient. It's not enough. We bring that sense of constant movement and irritation with life into the very process of stillness itself, into the very method in which stillness is supposed to arrive. So how much of our sitting, let me just ask yourself something, how much of your sitting is really contented sitting? How much have you really released yourself and said, okay, this is it, right here? Or how much of it is a seeking, a very subtle form of seeking, but a seeking of some sort of improvement? And where does that seeking come from if it doesn't come from discontentedness that drives our life? That drives our sense of needing to be somebody. I love the fact that we're all aging here together. I think there's going to be a lot of juicy topics that come out of this aging process together, because mostly my conversations now have to do with how body failure. What do we think? This is a mistake. Aging's a mistake, right? So paradoxically, Buddhism doesn't work against our need to be somebody, even as we learn to be silent. But let us be real clear about what Buddhism does. Everything that we do, every method, every tool, every meditation has at its root a movement towards stillness. Everything. And we frame all of our practice so that we can come to that stillness. Why? Because the stillness is the moment of contentment, is the moment in which the somebody-ness gives way to nobody. And that tension of somebody is fed through that sense of discontentment. And yet all Buddhism, if we say sit, allow, why, if we say allow, isn't that the essence of contentment? If we say don't judge, isn't that the essence of contentment? If we say just be with, isn't that the essence of contentment? On and on. All of the instructions I give in the beginning class, I give 6 weeks of those instructions, and I could just say, come in and be content. Come in and be content. What does that mean? But you don't understand. But maybe I don't understand. But then maybe you don't understand. Because it feels so real, doesn't it? It feels like, well, you know, I've got this problem, you know, and I just can't come in and say, I'm content. You know, you see how the assumptions of self feed upon the assumptions of self. And then our whole activity and our whole strategy comes in the working and the doing and the manipulating and the empowering and the joining and the collecting and the, you know, then, now, oh, okay. Right. But not the essence of the instruction. The essence of the instruction are to sit down and be. Just sit down. And this internal battle that we feel between being somebody and being nobody is really the friction between being still and quiet in ourselves and the noise that we keep trying to perpetrate to assure ourselves that we're still here even as we sit in silence. We need that rub. We need that discontentment. And we foster that discontentment so that we know that we're still alive. We can feel ourselves. When I was working with the dying, sometimes people wouldn't take their medication. And you'd go up to them and you'd say, well, why aren't you taking your medication? And no matter what you did, you know, they just would refuse it. And then when you had I remember this one particular man when I had just a brief moment and I was sitting down with him and not trying to force him to take his medication, and I was just asking him why he wasn't doing it, he said, because when I feel pain, I know I'm still alive. And that's our predicament. All of our predicament. When we feel pain, we know we're still alive. And so we create pain in ourselves instead of moving towards the real healing that meditation is supposed to direct us towards. We perpetuate the pain even within our meditation. This is what I was reading, Stephen Levine's new book, Turning Toward the Mystery. I just want to read this. Though Vipassana, mindfulness practice, which is what we're doing here, was not originally intended for psychological healing, but rather the development of a non-judgmental, clear-sighted, choiceless awareness, it is one of the most powerful tools for psychological psychological clarification available. In the course of penetrating the hindrances to clear seeing, the obstacles to the heart, mindfulness defines them and makes them susceptible to healing. Meeting mind moment after mind moment with a merciful awareness gradually brings the object of mindfulness into balance. Mindfulness harmonizes each part of us with the whole. In the arising of silent understanding, there is transmitted one of the great insights of spiritual and particularly mindful practice. Awareness heals. Awareness heals. You see, there isn't a great deal we have to do. But we do a great deal anyway. We make it much harder than it need to be. Because of our need to be somebody. Now, that's not to ridicule that, but it's to know it, to know what we're doing, not to be fooled by it. Remember, the knowing is the way out. So know what we're doing. Know that we're just, I mean, the endless problems that come just through the sense of sitting. And the struggles we create with our meditation. And many of us feel the effects of our lives of wanting to be a good boy or a good girl in relationship to our meditation, wanting to do it right, wanting to strive for the perfection of being somebody, when that's not what meditation is about at all. Meditation is about seeing the noise of the somebody. Seeing what we put between ourselves and the stillness of nobody. And knowing that we're doing that. Yes, we are out of control, and most of us feel completely out of control in that need to be somebody. But let us at least admit and own the fact of what we're doing. And we feel that we need to create the drama, the tension, the struggle, in order to have purpose and meaning, because the stillness waits for us, and what we project into that stillness is meaninglessness. Is that somehow, if we actually were quiet with ourselves, and that we didn't create any friction whatsoever, any residual noise, that our life would be meaningless. And most of us fear our life may be meaningless anyway. That's what we really fear. If I really looked into my life and it proved to be nothing, well, let me say very gently that the way and strategies that we employ are moving us in that direction. Because no matter what we do, it's going to be undone by the very nature of things. And where is there meaning in that? So you last 50 years beyond your death. I read where 500,000 years from now, there will be no life on this earth whatsoever. So if you did something really, really great, it doesn't matter if it's 5 billion years. It doesn't matter if it's 5 minutes, does it? So we think, wow, therefore my life's meaningless. Well, in that direction, that's the inevitable conclusion. It's got to be. So why not try the other way? And see whether life is meaningless in this moment. To do that, though, instead of being driven by the pain, We have to go into the pain. Because up until this point, much of our activity, strategies, and struggle have been in aversion to the pain, in resistance to the pain. This sense of discontentment in me, the sense of wanting to be acknowledged, all of that, drives certain actions, certain pretentious actions, so that I can somehow move. You see, if I boister myself up through self-improvement, empowerment, writing books, etc., then for a moment that pain isn't felt quite as acutely because I've pushed my head above yours. But then I have to go back to home. And I have to sit down at the dinner table. And suddenly I'm lonely again. See, we don't get out of it. And so then I have to go out and do something else. Or I create drama. Create myself involved. Get myself enmeshed. Get myself totally... But then I have to go home again, you see, where nothing's happening. And so we have to realize that this push from pain just creates more tension and inevitably implodes upon itself so that we feel our own existential pain. But if we move towards pain, towards that sense of discontentment, which is what the practice is supposed to do, it plumps us down and says, deal with yourself. And so how much time do we spend in our head not dealing with ourselves? And then we feel this discontentment. And before we know it, we're conjuring up a whole fantasy world to get away from that discontentment, to improve upon that discontentment, to make it go away while we're sitting. Instead of just saying, okay, I'm feeling this, okay. This is it, discontentment. We think the discontentment, if we go into it, if we take our seat within it, will show us what we fear we are. Meaningless. That's what we're afraid of. If I take a seat in my discontentment, that'll be proof that I'm a meaningless nobody. But the practice is just see it. Just be aware of it. Just be aware of that. Let that sense of knowing, okay, this is it. I see what, okay. Even if I play out the old strategies, it's okay. I know it. Okay, I'm still playing. I'm doing it. Fine. The knowing, the seeing is the healing. The awareness is the healing. Because the awareness is the nobody. The nobody heals the somebody. When we're aware of being somebody, nobody is healing somebody. And nobody always is the source of healing. Because how it works is that awareness of something begins to show you the impersonal quality of that which you're aware of. So we don't take something so personally. We're not driven by it so much. With less pain, there's less need to be somebody. When there's less need to be somebody, which is the only reason that we have ever been driven to be somebody, is because of the pain of wanting that. And when we begin to deal with the pain, then there's stability of consciousness that comes. Instead of being driven by it, which is instability, we're able to hold it, which is stability. When we are stable, consciously stable in ourselves, we don't feel like nobody. We feel like presence, awareness, aliveness. Because it was only our neurotic need which was leading us to always accumulate and add to the somebodyness. Without that neurotic need, which dies on the vine when we just watch it, when we just observe it, because we can hold it, you see, once it's held, it no longer motivates. It's okay. Discontentedness. Not my discontentedness, just discontentedness. Just a moment of discontentedness, a moment mood, a mood. It's a mood. It doesn't point anywhere. It doesn't establish any reference point. I'm not a placeholder. I mean, science is showing this. It always gets me that I don't understand why scientists aren't actualized human beings until you realize that they're just seeing it, or they're studying it. They're not seeing it for themselves. But that's what science is showing us. That there's nobody in here. So we become nobody by studying the somebody. Not by ridiculing and degrading our ambitions. Okay. See, we want to be some of us want to be a spiritual somebody. And therefore, I shouldn't have any desires or ambitions or no need to be, you know. And so then we just move on that line. We just move counter. We're countercultural. A new identity. And some of us have such an abusive history that we would love to be nobody. And we're just waiting to be nobody. But what we really want is to be out of our skins, and then we can be nobody. Not to be in our skins, not to be embedded, not to be alive in the pain of our tragic childhoods. That's too awful. I want to escape myself is what that particular strategy does. But all of this is heartfelt. I'm not saying it all in ridicule. It's deeply heartfelt. We're all caught in this juggling, this strategy of keeping ourselves alive. Because the silence is what? What is it? Right now, what is it? How terrible is it? How disorienting is it? Can anything be more meaningful than this? Can anything be more alive than this? Why do we have to beat drums? And mindfulness, that simple tool of just awareness, just being present. Just being present shows us true figure ground. It shows us what is true and what is just madness. And we just begin to negate the madness. The Buddha said, any thought of I is sheer madness. Just negate it. Just by negating it, it's not to degrade it. It's just to let it go. It's like a wind. So it's just, okay, the wind of I. Just the wind of I. Just the breeze of I. That's all. Just the breeze. And back to stillness. See, our attempts really in fostering the sense of I have always been an attempt to connect. We want to connect. We want to validate. We want to validate ourselves. And the way we've tried to connect is through ownership. Because that's as close as we can come from the sense of I, is to get proximately close. Proximity. But if we release the breeze just to blow, connection is there. It doesn't take force of will to connect with the breeze. It takes just releasing ourselves to feel the breeze. That's all. And to not let the ego assertions gives temporary relief. Yes, it makes you feel better by comparison. It works because you can put your head up higher than others. And that gives us temporary satisfaction as we look down on, I'm better than. But we're all in quicksand. And our heads just keep, we just keep going. How do we stay afloat in that? By madness. So when we are quiet, the quiet is the nobody observing the somebody. Stillness observing our pain. Just being. So we meet all the storyline with open arms, just being quiet with it. So the story goes on. The story of the me goes on, just the breeze. And we just sit, not denying anything, not aversive to anything, just seeing, just seeing, just seeing. In the seeing, there is stillness. In the awareness, there is quiet. And the more we spend seeing, the quieter we become. The less we get involved in the complexity of the I building, the more we have the tranquility and contentment of just the seeing. In the seeing, there is connection. In the I building, there is separation. We move out to build the I. We feel our loneliness and we hurt. We come back, fall back into quietness. And we heal. And we keep going out and keep coming back. And over time, it dawns on us, geez, I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to blow myself up anymore. I don't have to try to raise my head above yours. And then everything is quiet. Can we sit for a minute or two? So just to notice the need to be somebody. Not to condemn yourself for having that need. The fallback is not a counter punch in the opposite direction. It's just seeing. Just awareness. Bring nothing to anything but awareness. And let awareness do everything, because awareness heals.